Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle and joining me on this fine Thursday, a new slot for the Squawker Talker Podcast, is Chief Writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome to the Thursday slot, Mo.
Yeah, I'm completely disoriented. I had a mad commute and like it's now it's Thursday and I'm recording a pod. I don't know what's going on. It's like I'm very confused.
I'll tell you what's going on. Some serious predictions are going to be happening later on in the podcast. Joining us to do that is Chief Editor at Squawker, Will Hall. Welcome to Thursday.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. And the final guest, Rich Content Editor, on a Thursday slot as well, Sam Long.
How's it going, mate?
It's going very well. And I'll tell you why it's going so well, is we do have a bit of news to announce to everyone before we dive into some Super Cup action and then prediction previews. This season, the Squawker Talker Football Podcast will be sponsored by BetBull. 38 episodes throughout the season will be sponsored by them, which is brilliant news for us. It means we can keep giving you all of the Squawker Talker content that you want. And I should say that BetBull is the exclusive community where you can bet together and win together, obviously, if you're 18 plus and you are gambling aware. But you can even follow Squawker on the BetBull app, which you can download from a link in this podcast description. We'll be doing an acca each week based off our Squawker Talker inspired predictions, but we should warn you that they won't necessarily be the elite predictions you are hunting for. But BetBull obviously has a top 25 leaderboard where you can follow the best tipsters if you are looking to make the most of predictions. But if you want to come along for the Squawker Talker ride and make sure that we are keeping tabs on Mo's predictions that he claims to be making every week, then you need
to escape.
Yeah. I never said every week. I just said every occasion.
But now we can track it because we'll be on there each week. Make sure you download the BetBull app. As I said, 18 plus be gambler aware. We're so grateful for them for sponsoring the podcast. It should deliver, as I said, some excellent content. But before we get into predictions, which we'll be putting on our BetBull acca this week, we do have to start with the Super Cup, which the Thursday slot allows us to do. We can finally review some European football. And I imagine that last night's penalty shootout win, which, in my opinion, to say it straight off, was better than the actual Champions League and Europa League final. I found it a really enjoyable watch. It wasn't a convincing Liverpool win, but unlike in previous years, they're picking up trophies now. So does it even matter, Will? Should they be worried about the defensive issues?
Well, the first caveat is, and the reason it, what makes it seem even less convincing is the fact that Liverpool are really yet to arrive this season. So the first caveat I would say is that Liverpool's front three are yet to start a game together. And the second caveat is that they've set the bar so high that, like Man City, they're such an excellent team that picking out weaknesses, you almost have to be hypercritical. And what we've seen this season so far from Liverpool, I think, is that the passing is maybe a little bit off, which is not necessarily new. And a lot of teams, you know, start the season a bit sluggish. Passing is one of those things that sort of tends to click into gear as you get more match time together. If you remember after the Champions League final, when we were talking about what Liverpool can do to take the team to the next level, I referenced Arsene Wenger's comments about maybe the technical ability
there you go.
Throughout the team could be improved.
Arsene does it again.
Yeah. But I think the way in which Liverpool pass and their playing style doesn't help, because you've got your two box-to-box midfielders, in last night's case, James Milner and Jordan Henderson, and they almost have to like play the pass, instantly bomb on. Mm. And if you misplace that pass, then it almost becomes, anyone who's done like the shuttle run test knows that it's very exhausting, sort of like you triggered, you go one way and you've got to sort of immediately shuffle back. And against a team that pressed as well as Chelsea did last night and had N'Golo Kante in the team.
Injured
N'Golo Kante, basically man of the match.
Yeah. Sarri as well, sitting in his chair, slipping up.
Doesn't help.
A puff of a cigarette after he was deployed ahead of Jorginho.
And they've also taken one of their best passers out of the team in Trent Alexander-Arnold, who has been criticised during the opening two games for lacking defensive awareness. Mm. I think Mo goes along with that. Not that I'm trying to like sort of
no, spark a fate or anything. I was actually going to jump in because I was going to say, yeah, I've actually criticised him for, he is especially not a great defender, but if you look at it, to go exactly with what you're saying, is when he plays, conversely, Liverpool as a whole may be more solid defensively because he is such a better passer than Joe Gomez. And he contributes so much more to the midfield. And those passes that you're talking about, Milner and Henderson, they don't have to play them as much if Alexander-Arnold's about, because he can play them, or he can just launch those spectacular long balls that he does. So while I do think I can see the idea of playing Gomez ahead of him because Gomez is a better defender, but I think conversely it doesn't work for the way Liverpool's system is, because...
Well, you say that Gomez is a better defender and he was criticised for his performance last night.
He wasn't good.
I agree. I mean, I think the reason there's a perception of him as being the better defender is because he's naturally a centre-back, and then you associate sort of defensive awareness more so with that position than you will do the full-back. But his weakness when you play him at right back is he's playing in a position in which, I know that he started off his career there, as young players often will, but he's playing a position that doesn't feel as natural to him. And so his positional awareness isn't necessarily better than Trent Alexander-Arnold's in that position, I don't think.
It was funny because remember in the Barcelona defeat in the Champions League last season,
because we
said, didn't we, who's he going to play at right back? And he went for Gomez there.
Yeah.
And they lost. And then you put Alexander-Arnold in the home leg. Obviously, a game state was different because they were chasing 3-0, but they didn't even concede in that game.
It's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because I think defensively you have issues with both, because as Will says, Gomez is not a right-back, and I don't think he's built to play in Liverpool's system either. Like Will said, the way that they pass and play football, with Gomez in there, you lose so much of that it almost becomes pointless that he can defend well, and he can't even really defend that well in right-back. Which is what you saw against Barcelona last night as well. And then Alexander-Arnold, he may also have his defensive flaws, but what he gives you with the ball is so much more. As we saw against Barcelona, as we saw perhaps against Norwich as well, and we'll see, that even, he'll be defensively exposed sometimes, but it's the trade-off. It's what you do with all great attacking fullbacks. It's what we've been giving Marcelo, Dani Alves, all these great attacking fullbacks. You say, defensively they can get caught out sometimes, but they give you so much with the ball that... It's just because Alexander-Arnold's English. We're not used to saying, we can give him that license. Because usually we give it to Brazilians. It's like, oh, Dani Alves, he's more of a winger than a fullback, isn't he?
I was going to say, Chelsea's first goal last night, it was just that half second of hesitation between Gomez and Matip. Gomez wasn't sure if he was going to come inside and pick up Pulisic. And then as Pulisic drifted across, it opened up the gap. And I'd probably say if Alexander-Arnold was playing, then he would have had the pace to get back and maybe make that tackle that Gomez didn't.
I think Gomez is seen as the better athlete though in general anyway. That's why he usually plays. I think he's definitely quicker than Alexander-Arnold.
Trent's got that kind of ranginess
he's also got longer legs. But no, I think Gomez made a couple of good blocks last night that showed his athleticism. I think the main thing is exactly what Will said, he hit the nail on the head, is that the way that Liverpool passed the ball is what made, it's converse, because obviously you never think of Liverpool, obviously you think of City as defending with the ball. And not that Liverpool do that, but Liverpool are more defensively solid when they pass the ball well and when they press well. And I don't think they pressed with consistency last night, which is part of what exposed the heart. And then they passed it poorly, as Will says.
Before we come on to some positives, I think, with Liverpool.
There's no Liverpool positives on this part.
Hold on. I think we need to make amends for our previous sins. But and also there'll be, I assume, some positives on Chelsea.
Mm.
I think if you look at the goals in which Liverpool have conceded... they seem to be really susceptible to through balls at the moment, as we saw. Because basically the Giroud goal comes from Kante sort of just dribbling at Fabinho, and then he sort of lets him come through, and then it gets played through, and it's played through at such an angle where it's difficult to ascertain which centre-back should assume accountability and go with the runner for that one because it's so drifting across. But one of the facets of Liverpool's defence that is one of their biggest strengths as well is that they've clearly been instructed to put absolute faith into their offside trap since Van Dijk joined. Mm. And I think that's why Trent Alexander-Arnold looked so slow to react for the Pukki goal in the Norwich game. And basically, I think you would say takes most of the blame for not tracking the striker who ultimately finishes the ball in that sense. And it might have played a role in how they just allowed sort of Giroud to drift through, and
allowing Giroud to drift through and get on the end of a through ball.
And I can say that quite confidently, I think, because Chelsea had two goals disallowed from offside, so it's clearly something that you know, Liverpool depend on. And when we looked into this midfield the last season about Van Dijk's influence, it did seem that they might not have been necessarily right at the top. I can't remember, but Liverpool were very high in terms of offside.
I remember
traps.
When you stumbled across this before. Yeah. But as you said, we will move on to some positives of Liverpool before we analyse Chelsea. And if their first half wasn't inspiring, it was Bobby Dazzler coming on at half time that seems to unlock Liverpool in the sense, and that was everything that I was seeing. And it started every time you think, oh, Sadio Mane is the most important person in that front three, he scores so many important goals. Mohamed Salah's first two games, oh, he's definitely the most important. His output, dribbling ability is unparalleled in the team. Firmino doesn't play. Roberto Firmino is the most important player in that Liverpool front three because he knits everything together. So it's almost as if, and as a get-out clause, is they are all so important to each other's games that it just infinitely increases Liverpool's output and makes them... That is the crux of what Liverpool made them so good last season, is that it's a perfectly balanced, deadly, elite, world-class attacking front three.
It's a very sort of sensitive ecosystem the Liverpool team seems to be, because if you don't have Trent there, then the chemistry with Mohamed Salah is going to sort of reduce your attacking output on the right.
And even Mane.
And
the
crosses
into Mane at the back post.
And then if you don't have Roberto Firmino there, then the, as we've said, the sort of box-to-box midfielders who seem to misplace quite a few passes, Milner and Henderson last night. Fabinho as well hasn't been like amazing. He's played some sort of like slack balls himself. But without Firmino there to sort of drop back and trade passes and sort of get the ball up the pitch, they suffer and can suffer in a defensive sense as well, because like I said, if they're misplacing passes, they've then got to, and then have sort of jumped ahead a bit and then tried to push forward, and then we've got to bomb back and cover more distance.
And Firmino usually charges back himself to win it. So he definitely changed that Liverpool team, and obviously didn't get the assist technically for the first one, but then did get one later. So I think Klopp said after the game as well, like, Mane's been back 5 minutes, but still scored two. The next game will be maybe the game where they finally all start together, depending if how much the travel was. Obviously, it went well into 1 o'clock in the morning, the actual game.
Poor Southampton.
Well, that's what happened to them last season as well, wasn't they? Salah broke his streak against Southampton.
Also got one of Joel Matip's trademark runs that you enjoy so much.
Yeah.
He sort of went on his
adventure. Striding forward. And Gomez did one as well when he got played as an inverted left-back in the second half as well to bring Trent on. So that's covering Liverpool. Obviously, the main point is they've won another trophy. Adrian, fairy tale story there, comes in, saves a penalty, which was not the best by Tammy Abraham, but the parallels with Chelsea's last Super Cup defeat was incredible, because it was 2-2, 5-4 on penalties, and it was a young Romelu Lukaku who missed the penalty there before. So the striker in his rookie season with Chelsea took the fifth but missed. It's gone pretty well for Lukaku afterwards, despite recent disputes about his ability, which... For me, misguided. Like we will talk about.
He's wearing number 9 playing in the San Siro, mate. He's having a good time.
The last season of the San Siro. But no, quick. But not Lukaku podcast. Chelsea, who lost 4-0, and it could have been the end of the world. But Sam, we were saying off air as well that this Chelsea team and an injured Kante returning to midfield probably helped. They were actually quite fun to watch. They look promising.
Yeah, definitely.
And how great do you think Conte's impact was in that match?
So as we touched on, Sarri was slaughtered for his use of him last season, moving him out of that anchor role, putting Jorginho in there and sort of being accused of favouritism, being too stubborn. Everything really was thrown at him. So a lot of people expected Lampard to go in and move Conte back into that deeper role. And you can sort of see why, because sometimes a bit last season he looked a bit lost further up the pitch, maybe a bit undecided in that final third, but he was superb last night, especially in the opening 45 minutes. Ended up completing twice as many take-ons with 8 as anyone on the pitch.
Yeah.
And this with a fitness problem is pretty incredible, really, when you think that he came on and sort of looked off it at Old Trafford, that a matter of days later he's putting in some serious minutes.
And even Lampard said he picked up a further knock in that Old Trafford game.
Mm.
And he played like he's...
He's superhuman, isn't it, really?
He's really special. Like, I mean, it looked like Redondo.
Is it James Miller that he nutmegs?
Yeah.
So it's literally Lionel Messi impression, basically.
it was unreal. Because everyone knows how good he can be defensively, and he can put in his performances where he just seems like he's everywhere, defensively, tackling everyone. And he did that last night. But then what he did with the ball, I mean, yes, Maurizio Sarri completely not vindicated. Although, of course, it probably couldn't have done that in Sarri's system because of the way that Sarri played a little bit slower. Whereas that Chelsea were playing a bit more, they had a deep mid-block press and then just he had extra space to run into. But my goodness.
It renders the whole narrative dominated the entire season a bit nonsensical.
No, it does. But it was always nonsensical anyway.
They identified Conte as having the ability to play there.
He's not the same player now though as he was back then, because you've got to think that all the whole season in which he's kind of steadily developed into a much better ball carrier.
But this is what he pointed, which is what coaching is.
It's almost as if Maurizio Sarri is a great coach.
Yeah. And even Barkley said, didn't he, if Sarri was my manager years ago, I'd be a much better player. So he obviously does have
so his game by numbers last night, 102 touches, 84% pass accuracy, 4 chances created, 3 tackles, 2 aerial duels won. He was even marking Van Dijk on.
Yeah, that picture is amazing.
It was unbelievable. I thought back to that quote that Hazard said about it felt like he was playing with twins. It felt like he was playing with triplets last night. There were so many of them on there.
Three-man midfield.
It was really special to watch. And I think it's we've all predicted, well, I certainly predicted doom and gloom for Chelsea
there
this
you
season.
Go.
But
it goes in with the collective we.
I didn't
put them in the top four, to be fair.
No, I mean, neither did I. I don't think they'll make top four anyway, but I predicted they might even slide down to mid-table. But honestly, if Conte plays like that, they'll be fine.
That's what I was going to say. Sorry, Sam. One thing that is, I think Chelsea, even against Man United in the first 25 minutes, they were fun to watch. And you've got, I think, the young players that we all, the collective sort of, oh, he's definitely good enough for Chelsea, give him a chance. I think Mason Mount's come in, and despite the criticism for Mourinho, obviously didn't start the Super Cup, but came on. And again, despite some little decisions in the final third that will come with more experience at a higher level, he looks completely ready to play for a top Premier League team.
I think his penalty just completely demonstrates his technical quality.
When I sort of analysed him before, I said that he has a lot of similar traits to Kevin De Bruyne, in the sense that it's someone that is not necessarily really fast or an expert dribbler, but does it really well without you knowing.
Can have a shot too.
And the technique, wait until you start seeing Mason Mount on free kicks, crossing the ball in. He's playing on the left and cutting in a lot recently, so you'll see him going for top corner, but he can play on the orthodox side as well, and he'll start curling in. So I'm really excited to see him.
If he's anything like Kevin De Bruyne, they'll loan him to the Bundesliga.
This is what I mean. They're almost parallels, because it's like, you know, you've got this prodigious talent, and maybe if there wasn't a transfer ban, maybe he would have had another loan abroad. But this could be the sliding door moment.
What's interesting for me is that obviously last season, Sarri had his set way of playing, and Chelsea, you can even predict their substitutions down to a T. Whereas now, Lampard has spoken of his desire to be flexible, changeable, and to change formations within the game. And that's just not what we saw from Chelsea last season. So you think about Kante being able to play in those two different roles. With him in there, Chelsea will be able to change their system just without even having to make a substitution by changing his role.
Yeah, I can see, because the people want Kante to play into sort of a, because he's never played as a holding midfielder apart from with France, but with Leicester he played next to Drinkwater. So I think people were wanting the two-man pivot again.
Yeah, it's like
he was unleashed.
Yeah, and that's what Zola said, wasn't he? He said he's never been a holding midfielder. When it was Leicester, it was Drinkwater holding. When it was Chelsea, it was Fabregas holding. It was never him holding.
Well, he was the shuttle runner for someone that didn't necessarily have quote unquote the legs.
Essentially, Kante is a player you want to give 360 degree freedom to, right? To push up, press, to go back and press, to go back and tackle, to make runs wide and do whatever he wants, because he has this sort of all range ability. Apparently, he's an amazing dribbler. Who knew?
I know. I was genuinely taken aback by some of his little forays forward. I was like,
I know he can puff.
You know the adage of like the blood's gone to his head or something, and then like as soon as he goes past the final third, nosebleed. But then he was just like weaving through and sliding little passes into Pulisic, who just quickly as well looks very bright in his.
I mean, this is the thing. This is why you have to feel a bit of optimism for Chelsea, which has completely flipped me around. Kante is amazing, but then Pulisic in the final third, what you were going to say was they lack a bit of. They could seem to lack a bit of danger, because Giroud is great, but Giroud needs service, right? And Hudson-Odoi's not coming back till when? Is he going to be 100%? You know, so you don't know about the service, quite the service. Pedro played very well, but he's 33. He kind of do that all season. Willian is 30, whatever it is. He didn't play consistently well anyway. Tammy Abraham. I mean, I love Tammy Abraham, but he missed that gilt-edged chance right at the end. Does he have the killer instinct needed?
But
I don't know.
As I always say, yeah, having that chance is an indicator of a good striker, better than someone that was
missing. Yeah, no, his movement is exceptional. The way he uses the ball is very clever. He had a very... But it's just that killer instinct. Does he have the score the goals is what I mean. But Pulisic, you can see he has that. You can see he's not afraid of anything. Scored that amazing goal. I mean, obviously it was offside, but like...
Yeah.
An inch or whatever it was. But it was, you know, he's got that sort of drive, the thrust, the pace, the turner pace, the way he can just start from...
His acceleration.
Yeah, from 0 to 60 in like 0.1 second. Like, he's gone. So he's really quick. He's really bright. He seems to have that killer instinct to score goals. I think you look at him, you look at Kante, you look at Shakeo Tomori was very good when he came on. I thought he was really good at the back. It's more solid, I would argue, than Christensen was, frankly. He really wasn't outmatched by any Liverpool centre-backs, any Liverpool's forwards, sorry. So I think
Emerson's been, shows that he's got the ball-carrying ability needed that Marcus Alonso doesn't give.
Sarri's said that the reason what was keeping Emerson out of the team was his height. That's at one point of vote. It's strange to hear that from Sarri and then Frank Lampard.
Yeah, just slide back in. I think it's shown instantly that Marcus Alonso, when he's arriving late at the other wing as a fullback, no one can beat him in the air, and that's a weapon in itself. But as soon as you play a back four, play someone that can carry the ball. And that's why I think the final piece of the puzzle will be that Reece James in at right back. Because Azpilicueta has not been...
He's not been brilliant. He's not been good at all. He looks ropey.
I think Azpilicueta, Ollie Young-Miles, who's old school Talker listeners might remember, pointed out to the fact that maybe because he's played almost every minute for the past four seasons, might be carrying a bit extra in his legs. And that shows when he's asked to play a very dynamic right-back role. Azpilicueta is a brilliant defender, but he's being asked to get really far up the pitch and he's not necessarily got the pace to get back, which... Reece James does have, and Lampard said he'd be a big player when he comes back from injury, and from watching Chelsea in these first two games, how Chelsea looked to play, I completely have faith that Reece James will fulfil that promise and be played as the first team right back. But we will wrap up Super Cup action there, take a little pause, and we'll dive into previewing the weekend's Premier League action. Promise, we now move from review to preview, and the first game we're going to be talking about is actually the final game of the weekend, Wolves versus Manchester United, mainly because this is the game that I think we can all agree is the most intriguing, in the sense that Man United's 4-0 win against Chelsea has done exactly what the initial Solskjaer Ollie's at the wheel movement was about last season. They're now super excited about the campaign. Harry Maguire is worth 200 million, let alone 80 million. And Wan-Bissaka will not be dribbled past. Rashford's going to score 40 goals. They're a counter-attacking unit that will devastate any team in their way.
All of that is true.
All of that has been touted. And they are actually statistically the best counter-attacking team since Solskjaer took over, which was quite a nice little angle.
Rashford has more fast break goals than anyone else at time four.
Yep. So, how do you unleash your fast break merchant against a team that completely refuses to be counter-attacked and will only counter-attack themselves? Obviously, Man United face Wolves on the Monday night football. Wolves beat them twice in a week last season under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I personally would just immediately go with Wolves on this one. I just think Man United are going to come unstuck. Yeah. But no one wants to hear me say that, Mo. So,
No, I'll say that instead. We'll Man United going to come unstuck. This is the kind of game. It's what we saw in the Community Shield was that Man United will probably give anyone a game on the break this season. Anyone, because you Harry Maguire
in the Community Shield.
I think Maguire. You look at Maguire in a mid to low block, and he's just impenetrable. Wan-Bissaka in the middle of the block is just, you can't get past him. Lindelof playing between those two becomes supremely energised. Luke Shaw is still a weakness, but you know, you can cover up for one weak link in your defence.
Jose Mourinho couldn't resist, could he?
It's funny.
It was true.
He was poor. He was very poor.
I showed you the average positions, didn't I, afterwards? And Luke Shaw's like, halfway line, Wan-Bissaka's sort of a touch back. So Maguire will cover, but the reason they bought him is that they now have confidence that he will be able to cover.
Yeah, no, so on the break, United engineered, you saw it against Chelsea, they tried to play out against Chelsea, tried to actually engage with in a game with Chelsea, and they did okay. It wasn't disastrous, but they let a lot of chances go through them because their midfield is not built to stop. They didn't sign an attacking midfielder. Keep the ball. They didn't sign a top-class defensive midfielder. They'll protect the defence. So there's no real sort of... You can walk through them like a sieve, basically, their midfield. When they went to a low block, suddenly all the weaknesses were no longer energised. McTominay, in a small amount of space, is impenetrable. He's big. He's got long limbs. So they kill Chelsea on the break. And they'll kill loads of teams on the break. But Wolves don't let you do that. Mm. Wolves will be like, come on. Do you want the ball? Go on, have the ball. And, United fell for it twice in a week last season. I wonder if Solskjaer will fall for it again. You almost love to see them. Like that Simpsons thing where they're all passing the ball, halfback pulls it. You almost want to see United dare Wolves to have the ball and try and. But I don't think it'll happen. I think United have too many expressive and talented players, and Wolves are too well drilled. I think Wolves will lull United forward, and then they'll hit them. But whether they'll be able to hit them on the break as successfully with Maguire and Wan-Bissaka
It's Wan-Bissaka for me.
Well, mainly, yeah.
All of our pre-season analysis of that signing was that you've signed Mr. Recovery.
Yeah.
So if they're aiming for their left wing channel...
Yeah. Which they will, because Jota and...
Now, all of a sudden, Man United is so much more solid and able to deal with that threat. We saw in pre-season that even if Wan-Bissaka loses the ball himself,
he gets back.
He will stop the counter-attack with his Spider-Man like.
One thing that was super interesting about that average positions thing that you showed me was how Pogba, when he's in Man United's half and he's sort of in defensive mode, he hovers around Wan-Bissaka because Wan-Bissaka can sort of like cover for him if he misplaces a pass or like loses the ball or gets his pocket picked. But then when he's in the attacking half, he's on the left, sort of drifting around, confining. And it just, it's related as well to the Luke Shaw weakness. You basically couldn't have Pogba on that side and Luke Shaw there.
And it also speaks about, again, it's what we identified as that asymmetry that Man United should use going forward. Pogba is all, the referees have to walk that diagonal line to make sure they're covering every angle of the pitch with the linesman. Pogba's doing that himself.
Yeah.
When he's defending, he's going towards the more defensive area of Man United's side to cover for that. So that he can be unleashed on the break like he was against Chelsea. But then as he moves up the pitch, he goes diagonally towards the left to associate with the fullback naturally going to be further forward.
Pogba's runs are at their best when they are diagonal. The run that he made for Dan James's goal, you can see he was literally on the left touchline, bombed forward, played the 1-2 of Martial and then cut into the middle of the pitch. So, his movement is by far, it's because he's not necessarily the fastest runner on a straight line. But, when you move him...
When you've got a 10-metre stride.
When you put him on a slight angle, put him on a stride, he gets away from you in a hurry. I think United are... They missed the trick. This is why I've been banging on all summer. They need to sign Maddison. Need to sign Maddison or Eriksen or Dybala. They clearly knew they needed a number 10. They've been trying to sign one all summer. It didn't work in the end, obviously, because they were rebuffed. The Maddison thing just went nowhere. Dybala didn't want to come. Eriksen didn't want to come. So they knew they needed a number 10. They needed a number 10 for games like this because when the opponents just sit in and don't come out against you, how do you break them down? You need someone. It can't all be Paul Pogba. He can't do everything himself. And the problem is
But even Paul Pogba, his biggest strengths always come to the fore in transition.
Yeah, because
he can either exploit his pass to Marcus Rashford was world class. He's capable of doing that. But he also, and he did it against Arsenal in the FA Cup, he will one-man counter-attack you and break two lines with two strikes.
Yeah, but the thing with also what he is he's United's best passer of the ball as well, and which means, he has the pass to break down a defence, but if it's all on him, he goes into hero mode, and then that's where you don't want Paul Pogba, because then he starts doing silly things, starts trying to do too much, and it doesn't work. If you had a number 10, a capable ball-playing number 10, and this is why I think Juan Mata might start against Wolves, because I think after Pogba, he's their best passer. He doesn't really fit their style of play, but... They're going to have to change the style of play to break down Wolves anyway. They're not going to counter Wolves.
It's going to have to be a completely different iteration.
I would not be surprised at all to see maybe even Mason Greenwood start instead of Jesse Lingard, because I think Jesse Lingard's not so good when...
He's off the ball, isn't
he? Yeah. So I think... I think Juan Mata has to start, because I think they should have signed a 10. They didn't sign a 10. Okay, whatever, it's done. Mata is now their best, most perceptive passer of the ball. Andrew Gomez is obviously very promising, but he's still very young. You can't rely on him. So... I think Mata has to start.
He's older than Mason Greenwood, who you just said should be starting there.
Well,
Anyway, I think we understand that it's going to be a different Man United team.
Yeah, and I do think they won't work. I think they'll get caught. I think Wolves are too disciplined. They're too good at what they do.
Jimenez has been on fire as well, despite having no pre-season himself.
Yeah.
Winning the Gold Cup and then scoring in all their Champions League qualifiers. Yeah. Obviously, their first game, though, which is when we'll move this on, because we've got plenty to preview, was against Leicester. And they came unstuck against Harry Maguire 2.0. Didn't they, Sam?
Yeah, Sarunju looked really, really good against Wolves last week. He didn't get much game time last season. Ended up making just 4 league starts with Maguire, Evans and Morgan in front of him in the pecking order. And he actually only made 1 under Brendan Rodgers. But he looks really well suited to the way Rodgers wants to play. He's good on the ball, very aggressive, strong as well. 6'1", so not huge. And still mobile enough.
Do you know the dimensions of his head as well?
Cannot stack up to Maguire.
But he's close though, isn't it? He's got more hair to back it up.
Maybe more.
Showed some serious speed too.
That
clip that obviously sort of put him in the spotlight was that recovery pace from a Wolves counter-attack, surprise, surprise. Mm. And he actually dealt with it. So it'll be even more interesting to see if Maguire can now do what his understudy has actually done.
But yeah, if Leicester manage to replace Maguire from within and don't have to dip into that world record fee, that is a seriously shrewd piece of business. So I think it was 19 mil they paid last summer. So even if you take that into account, it's a big, big old profit.
Yeah, and I think his agent tried an Arsenal campaign, didn't it? I remember requesting a lot of articles about, his agent said that there's a deal agreed with Arsenal. It looks like they might have missed out based on that debut. And they've obviously got, I think mentioned when we did the predictions podcast, that they've got Benkovic as well, who's highly rated. So perhaps their plan all along was to not actually buy a centre-back and trust Sinchu and stuff. Mm. They come up against Chelsea this time around, who we've obviously spoken quite a bit about in the preview. But based on what we saw from Leicester, and they had, I think, the second highest possession of the whole weekend, but didn't actually create, I think there were 2 shots on target in the game or something like that. It wasn't, again, it was Wolves being impossible to break down. Mm-hmm. It was just Wolves' counter-attack that didn't come quite to fruition. But Tammy Abraham maybe will lead the line again after Giroud started. Lampard spoke a lot about the rest periods. He kept mentioning that Liverpool played Friday night.
Klopp did this as well, though. He was like sort of saying, Lampard asked me on the touchline, when are you playing at the weekend? I said Saturday, and he was like, good luck, mate.
So obviously they're getting
manager banter.
Good manager banter about, touchlines. But if we're going on that basis that you said as well, Sam, earlier, that Lampard's looking to rotate at every opportunity anyway, number 9, Tammy Abraham, do you think he's got any chance to maybe break that number 9 curse? And obviously now he's looking to overcome a penalty miss as well.
Yeah, I feel really bad for him because he sort of came out and made quite a big thing of taking the number 9 and it wasn't cursed, and it looks like it's cursed straight away. But I would say that he's been there before in terms of missing a pen. He missed one for the under 21s, I think it was in 2017 when we lost to Germany. And obviously that didn't break him. This is, of course, a much more high profile one to have missed. But I think Lampard's comments to come out and really sort of put the arm around him straight away suggest that Lampard is not going to shut the door on him like turned out to be the case when Lukaku missed and effectively ended his Chelsea career.
Lampard and Morris are the kind of guys who say, it's a mistake, you'll get over it, learn from it sort of thing, rather than, oh my God, you're young, you're rubbish, get out of my sight.
And also Lampard can't buy a striker.
Well, there's also that.
Yeah. But just by the virtue of Giroud, so the stat that came out yesterday, 12 goals and 16 appearances in European competition for Chelsea, but then just 7 in 49 domestic games. His form is going to come in patches or ebb and flow throughout the season. So Abraham's definitely going to get in there. In terms of the Leicester game, the other interesting thing is basically where Kante's going to play, because obviously you've got Tielemans and Maddison. So how are Chelsea going to try and shut down their creativity? I'd say if Jorginho plays as he did against Liverpool in the sort of lone midfield role at the back, then Jamie Vardy is going to be on him.
Yeah.
He's going to have no time.
2 red balls he might have for that game.
And then again as well, touching on Azpilicueta maybe being a bit of a question mark, Ben Chilwell one of Leicester's biggest strengths. So that's going to be another really interesting battle. He's going to need no second invitation to attack an ageing Aspilicueta.
You'd think that this game will suit both managers. As we said, Leicester were frustrated massively in the opening weekend. And I saw a lot of sort of like, oh, here we go again, like 69% possession, two shots on target. Chelsea, based on what we saw against Man United and Liverpool, are going to play one with one approach, not necessarily one way. We said that he's going to change formation, but they will look to be on the ball and attack. So this could be a really fun game in which we see sort of 4-2-3-1s go head-to-head. A lot of young talent on the pitch.
Pulisic versus Ricardo Pereira should be quite an interesting battle, I think, as well.
Mm. Exactly.
He's a really all-round fullback that no one seems to sort of give any credit to. And I mean, obviously, we saw Pulisic is fantastic as well. So I think that would be really interesting. There's a lot of good individual battles all around the pitch.
Yeah. But my major point was that this could end up being like a 2-2. It's obviously Lampard's return.
Oh, you love your 2-2s, don't you, Drew?
Yeah, I say 2 because 4 goals seems like quite a lot. So I always, and if I think it's going to be even, I just say that. Because if you say 3-1 Leicester, then that all of a sudden sounds like a big win.
Yeah.
So 2-2, maybe 3-3, something like that. Ooh. I just think there's going to be plenty of goals in that game because Brendan Rodgers will be sort of looking at those two games and thinking, yes, we can definitely take advantage here. The talent we've got, the pace of their front line. And then Chelsea will be thinking, right, we know Leicester are going to play. So this is where we can start working on our transition phases. Yeah. And maybe they finally won't hit the woodwork. And a goal will actually go in 3 times in 2 games already for Frank Lampard.
There's only so long that we can have the narrative of Chelsea playing well but not sort of getting the results. They still need to put the results together.
Yeah, exactly. It might wear off if they end up 16th with 40 goals conceded after the first few games. Do you have an inkling of who you maybe back for that game though, Chelsea-Leicester, which is on the Sunday? We've done it in reverse order this time.
I think Chelsea will win 2-1.
There you go. So nearly 2-2 is a similar take on that game. The next one we'll move on to quickly is Arsenal versus Burnley, which I've done this in the worst order possible. If you're looking for a chronological preview of the Premier League weekend,
it's not going well for your first pod hosting a preview of the upcoming weekend's games.
No,
it's like a Tarantino film. I'm doing it. Time's jumping all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. I'm doing it in the most fun way possible.
You're the Tarantino of podcast hosts.
I'll take that. but 12:30 is the Arsenal Burnley game, and obviously, all of the review about Arsenal's win at Newcastle was finally an away clean sheet, resolute performance, wasn't anything fancy. Arsenal get the win away from home, 3 points. Emery on the touchline going crazy. Callum Chambers is a rock. Socrates can beat anyone. But Mr. Ashley Barnes will have something to say about
this. This is what we're saying, right? Callum Chambers, I think, has been a rock. I think he's been really, really impressive all through pre-season. And I think he's given Emery a choice about, ooh, do I replace Socrates or him with David Luiz? Like, before it was like no choice at all. Like, Socrates can be a guy. But maybe now it's not. Maybe you play a back three. I don't know.
No.
but definitely, I think Ashley Barnes is a completely different level of test. Like, this is going to be it. Now, this is where we're going to see, all right. I mean, Arsenal have a great record against Burnley. I think they've won the last 5 games.
It belies the narrative of their struggle against Burnley.
Yeah, so I think, because I think ultimately what Arsenal have that Burnley can't deal with is very talented forwards. Mm. And I think Aubameyang, I don't know if Lacazette was ready to play yet or not, but you figure Pepe will play more of a role than he did against, but then I don't know, maybe not, because of course, remember, Unai Emery was very cautious bringing Torreira through last season. So maybe he'll do the same thing. I really hope he starts Dani Ceballos. But just because I always want to see more than anything else. Yeah. But I think Arsenal will have... It's a really boring prediction, but I just think Arsenal will have too much of Burnley. Burnley will give them a good game, but Arsenal will win in the end, because that's just what happens when Arsenal plays Burnley.
The good record against Burnley is actually punctuated by a lot of 1-0s, and Alexis Sanchez went on a streak of scoring controversial 90th-minute winners against Burnley. So it wasn't like... Arsenal have a good record against Burnley because they pummel them every time. It was Arsenal just seemed to manage to get a win. And last season's game at the Emirates, I went to that game, and Ashley Barnes versus Socrates was more of a wrestling match than it was a football match. Because Ashley Barnes, and on our predictions pod, remember we spoke about Burnley's formula, and it was very much high percentage balls, but relying on these two strikers who have... underrated on the ball quality. Ashley Barnes' finishing at the opening weekend was exceptional. I saw a lot of puns and alliteration going around about, what was it, Burnley's Burkamp and Bath's Benzema were mentioned, I think. Which maybe
you weren't fueling those rumours.
No, so. I know. I'm annoyed that it was Ruben Kinder that I saw do those headlines. I was annoyed that I didn't think of them myself. But it communicates the idea that Ashley Barnes, hold on a minute, Burnley have got a top-class striker here who isn't just built to cause absolute havoc with centre-backs. If he wins his battle, he will turn you and slot it in the corner as well. And this game against Burnley, it will be at home for Arsenal. But this will be the actual test now. It was Joe Ellington's first Premier League game. And he's not actually a proper centre-forward anyway. He likes associating with someone else. And he caused issues in the first 20 minutes. But now you've got Chris Wood and Ashley Barnes going up against maybe David Luiz's debut, which will be... It will be entertaining, basically. If it's David Luiz... if David Luiz, Socrates, Ashley Barnes are on the pitch together, then I imagine all of them will get at least a booking.
It's going to be fantastically good fun. I think Arsenal are going to be really, really good value for money this season. And I think you're right. I think it's going to be good fun. I think where it will be won and lost is in midfield, as it usually is. I think it depends on... Xhaka's passing is going to be very important. Is he going to be on point? Is he going to be Torreira? Is it going to be Dani Ceballos? We don't know. Is Guendouzi going
to
play?
Guendouzi's looking like he's making the improvements he needed to make to be a starting midfielder.
Yeah.
He and Dani Ceballos will be competing massively. If you watch them, they're actually really quite similar. Yeah. So he'll need to do that. I genuinely think it will be one in defence because Burnley don't really use their midfield that much. They'll look for... Now they've got Eric Peters.
But they completely bypassed it for the first goal, I think, against Southampton.
So this is what I mean. It'll be Socrates, whether he won't get sent off or not. And then Arsenal's actually ability to create... Because they didn't create many chances against Newcastle, which was a criticism of them last season as well, was they weren't having a lot of shots. So they need to actually try and force something. But it could end up just being a 1-0 win again to the Arsenal.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be... that complicated. I think, like you said, it's just going to be... I have a feeling Aubameyang might just do it again because he's
well, yeah. He's on very good. And his goal, again, well taken. If he starts actually taking those chances he gets, which as we said...
I mean, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Because he gets so many chances because of his movement. His XG is huge and it's like, but he always underperforms it. But if he's, you know, he's looking right now like he's just in one of those zones.
Just a serious season expected. So yeah, more yellow cards. I think yellow cards more than goals in that game is probably the way to go. The final game we're going to do in this little mini preview before actually focusing on Man City and Spurs itself, which is actually a huge game that I forgot was even happening. Will, some thoughts on Liverpool returning from the Super Cup, going to St Mary's. Southampton obviously 3-0 defeat in the first game.
So apart from that, it's teed up quite nicely for Southampton. Who are really waiting for their season to begin, obviously, because you got to kind of just put that 3-0 defeat to Burnley behind you, which was strewn with defensive errors and sort of poor defending, poor generally defending from certainly Vestergaard. I think Liverpool and Man City are going to be considered free hits for most Premier League teams until one of them hits a bad patch, which doesn't look like it's in the post necessarily. And definitely a Liverpool team with 120 minutes in their legs. It could be without Andy Robertson, obviously came off against Chelsea. I was going to suggest that maybe if... my prediction on this is like a narrow Liverpool win. And the goals that Liverpool score will be like full-back crosses, like Burnley sort of put in a couple of...
Burnley, yes.
So, and that still is the case, whether Robertson plays or not, I don't know. I've not sort of caught up with the injury news on that front. Trent Alexander-Arnold has the capability to do that anyway. And Southampton are another one of these teams who do like a bit of a press, and that will basically be all the competitive games that Liverpool have played so far this season have been against teams that are just going to sort of like bomb out that midfield that, as we've sort of explained during the sort of opening phase of this podcast, is looking like maybe a little bit of a weakness. And then Hassan Huttle has already said that ages ago, this is the sort of most commonly attributed quote when discussing what his Southampton team actually is that he wants to be nasty opponents. So that's not going to be nice for Liverpool either.
No, nasty's never nice.
Yeah, and I remember, the opposite, in fact. Yeah.
Some would say...
This fixture last season, the 3-1, despite the scoreline sounding like a quite simple game, was really tough for Liverpool at a point in which the pressure was really on them. I think they were chasing Man City at this stage. I think they'd fallen behind. And Southampton have troubled the big six, beating Arsenal and Spurs last season, and then, you know, putting decent performances against some of the others.
The crowd is always going to be up for it at Southampton as well, because
it nicks all our players.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a bit of a grudge match in that regard. So that's my prediction in terms of the complexion of the match. Because I like to go beyond the scoreline.
Yes. which is what we do on the Score of Talker podcast.
More than the score, I think,
we're referring. Yeah, it's literally ever. We are more than the score.
So I would go for 2-1. And a tough afternoon.
But we still give you the score. We're more than it, but you still get a score.
Oh, yeah, more than is more inclusive.
More than the 2-1, it sounds like, based on this podcast.
Bobby's
at the moment.
Bobby Firmino's going to score, isn't he? It's one of those games where he's going to pull something out
of
nowhere.
Well, I didn't want to go that in depth because you're maximising the amount of things that can go wrong.
I've already said
that it'll be Robertson assist, but yeah, that was my thinking. Maybe. I think Robertson assist for a Firmino goal. Mane goal, because he's obviously someone who's I think scored the most headers last season.
Yep. So, and he was the only one with five of each.
Yeah. So they can prey upon that sort of Vestergaard, Stevens.
Go. Yeah, despite Vestergaard being shakiness. 7'9".
I think the tallest defender in the league, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, I think you can check that on the Premier League website. Yeah.
Listeners, find out for yourself.
Here's a fun task for anyone listening.
And we'll wait.
Just can't resist checking heights of all Premier League players. We usually end up putting a tallest Premier League 11 together, so maybe that's something that will follow directly after this.
Also, with regards to the nasty comment, I did look into how many fouls they committed since Hassan Huttle took over, and it is the third most in the division behind Everton and Watford. So,
he's
talks the talk and he's walks the walk.
You've given me a segue there to talk about fouls. Fouls and Man City, name a more iconic duo. That's coming up next.
Yannick Vestergaard is the tallest at 199 centimetres. Forster is taller, but Forster's a goalkeeper, so Vestergaard's the tallest outfielder.
There you go. Man City's coming up next. So for the final section on this week's Squawk Talk of Football podcast, we'll be looking specifically at the Man City Spurs game, which, as I said, has not fallen into the chronological order of the weekend, but it's the biggest game already. You've been served up a repeat of that famous event in the Champions League last season, VAR denying Guardiola, and now it's possible it could happen in the Premier League as well. But the main thing we need to focus on, let's start with Spurs on this, because we haven't given them much time in recent podcasts. Christian Eriksen came on and, by all accounts, changed that game against Aston Villa, despite Spurs rattling in 30-odd shots, having the most possession in the weekend. It seemed to be aligned with when the Dane came on the pitch and didn't necessarily create loads himself or have an influence, but the areas he picked up on the pitch. Alan Shearer's match of the day analysis was really good. In the first half, Spurs' front three was so tight together. And then in the second half, they spread out a bit and Eriksen picked up the pocket. So he seems to just make Spurs play better. But the international transfer window, Will, has not closed yet.
No. Apparently they're open to selling him, which I find remarkable. Well, I don't find remarkable because you don't want to lose someone for nothing. So even though he reportedly wants to move to Real Madrid, it has got free transfer to Juventus written all over it.
Yeah.
For reasons we've explained on a previous pod.
Imagine them diving into North London.
They'd have to get rid of someone. They'd have to sell for a profit one of the midfielders they picked up on a free transfer. But according to The Independent, there will be further contract talk between Tottenham and Eriksen before the European transfer window shuts. That based on the fact that he was kind of, well, if you believe the reports, he was offered to Manchester United and didn't want to go there. If you believe that, then there's really only one or two destinations, and it's like Spain, essentially. Mm-hmm. He wants a lifestyle change. But the fact that they're still open to selling him suggests that the financial reasons could dictate this one, because there's no way you can spin it in terms of improves the Spurs' chances of on-field success if you get rid of him. You basically, and also coupled with the fact that they sold Trippier as well, and I know that Trippier wasn't universally popular among Spurs fans, but that would mean that they've sold their two top chance creators from last season, many of which will be from set pieces.
That's what I'm saying. Set pieces, you always ride me for giving a bit of a, making sure people are aware that it can skew some stats.
Yeah,
but if you sell all your set piece takers, then you just lose the actual value of them anyway.
But, and Eriksen does seem to create a lot of chances from set pieces statistically, but has a bad reputation among Spurs fans for never being able to beat the first man, which is funny. I think all fans of all clubs assume their set piece takers are terrible because corners very rarely result in goals.
And you see them close up if you're there as well.
And it just feels like it hits the first man all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah. Eriksen's free kicks are better than his corners, though, to be fair.
I think he's like leading the table for most goals from that side. Since he joined as well.
And he does it with both feet. Yeah.
He's statistically the most consistent creator of the last three seasons, having set up the most chances, 283. He's also got the joint most assists with 37 alongside Kevin De Bruyne. And if he assists 10 or more this season,
here he is.
He'll become the only person to do so for five consecutive campaigns in Premier League history, overtaking David Beckham's 10-year record. And you'd expect him to do so because he rarely misses games.
Yeah.
Doesn't have too many injuries. I think there was a spell where he was at last season. But if you look at his history over all of the seasons he's been at Spurs, it's rare that he misses.
And that's another major compliment of Eriksen's game, usually, is the fact that, because he's always paired with Ozil in the sense, they were battling for a long time until Kevin De Bruyne enjoyed four of the most chances created. And then it's always like, well, if Ozil had applied himself in the same way as Eriksen, which again, is probably not as extreme as I'm making out, but I'm using this to put a positive spin on Eriksen, that he's perceived to be an extremely hard-working midfielder as well as a supremely talented creator, which seems like the rarest breed of them all.
You can't play for Pochettino if you don't work hard, you know what I mean?
So it's a good exercise in sort of how perceptions and like the publicity that players get, often which is sort of, you know, designed by them, like engineered by them and their agencies, that like Eriksen's the unassuming one, the humble one, and Ertzl's like the sort of the flash, like genius that can sort of change a game in an instant. Yeah. I think because there's not in quality, there's rarely been little separating those two. And I would in fact say that Eriksen has just been much more consistent over the past three seasons, and therefore the better player. But
to be fair,
I don't know why this is descending into that.
It's because I planted it in your head.
I've caught you out now. No, Ozil is a genius. Eriksen is also a genius. And it was interesting because you look at, I think it's obvious why Spurs are willing to sell him. First of all, he's 28 now. This is
prime.
He's
27. He's entering the peak years.
This is what I was about to bring up. Eriksen is born in the same year as Jesse Lingard.
I mean, Jesse Lingard
and Carl Jenkinson.
Jesse Lingard is one of those guys. Everyone says, "Oh, he's a young player." He's not a young player.
No, but this is what I mean: is if your perception of Jesse Lingard is that he's relatively young,
it's because he only became relevant like 3 years ago, or 4 years ago. Whereas Eriksen's been around for a long time. Eriksen is very good, very, very good. The only reason Spurs are willing to let him go now is obviously because Pochettino's method for dealing with players who get a bit uppity about their contracts, like, "I want more money." He's like, "No, go away." Yeah, and I mean, he did with Walker. He doesn't tolerate players who get them. I mean, he dropped Vertonghen, didn't he? Because there's room for Vertonghen.
Danny Rose is probably the biggest example.
Eriksen definitely deserves more money, though.
100%.
He's been at the club for so long.
Everyone
has got new signing, sort of like Sissoko, earning more than him.
Spurs
have to face the facts that they have to play their best players good money, or they will lose.
Despite going public and
saying that he wanted to move, he's been quite well behaved in the whole situation.
Good boy, Christian.
I mean, look, basically, Spurs need to stop playing 2005 wages and start playing 2019 wages for everyone, not just Eriksen. But I can see where they want to send him because they've got Lo Celso in now, right? And Lo Celso is this. You can see how he comes in and replaces Eriksen, basically.
To an extent.
No, it's not one for one, obviously, but you can see what they're thinking is, we've got this guy, this shiny new guy, we can replace Eriksen with him. Frankly, I would want to pair them because I think having those two in your team makes you incredibly creative, but I can see what Spurs are thinking in terms of, we don't want to pay Eriksen what he wants. He wants too much money. Let's just sell him now for whatever we can get and then replace him with ourselves.
And if he's not going to sign a new contract, then it is...
Yeah.
Taking football, it's smart to try and sell him.
But just to rephrase this whole thing...
Yeah.
They're not.
Cool.
Delete
the rest of it.
They're not open. They're open to selling. Yeah. They're not actively trying to sell.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
I think their ideal, perfect world scenario would be he signs a new contract.
Yeah.
Because the other issue beyond the fact that he's consistently their top creator, and I think if you take Trippier and Eriksen, as we've sort of said earlier, out of their top chances, it's like Son is next on something like 30, which is not going to sustain a top four push. But
you want someone like, scoring the chances.
And this is maybe damning Spurs with faint praise, and I've said it a couple of times before, but they are outside of Man City, English top flight football's most consistent team of the last 5 years. So yes, they haven't won anything, but they've always been there. They've not suffered the declines that their big six rivals have. And that consistency is built around this nucleus of generational talent. And there's three people who symbolise that more than anyone else. It's Mauricio Pochettino, Harry Kane, and Christian Eriksen. And if they and also part of the reason they've been able to be consistent is despite, as Mo says, paying 2005 wages, it's actually really impressive how they've kept these players together, maintained the faith and belief in this project despite these players having offers to sort of double their wages immediately by just sort of going to Manchester United or something. But they've kept them together. And if you lose Eriksen, then you're potentially firing a starting pistol and you're shaking that belief, and then others might follow. Whether that will happen or not, it's impossible to say, and it's maybe a little bit dramatic to say, but you will be going into a situation where you're setting the precedent, you're taking the first step down that path. If you lose all of these players, you're no longer able to say that we've not lost anyone we didn't want to lose during this phase. And sort of losing one could basically sprout the leak that brings down the dam.
No, but that all depends on how you replace them. Because we all said the same sort of things about Walker, like, oh, this is it now. This is the reckoning. Now everyone's going to stop paying wages. But then what they did was they replaced him with Trippier.
Oh yeah,
noticed that. I mean, but it all depends on how essentially Lo Celso replaces Eriksen. Because if he comes in and he's brilliant and no one misses Eriksen, then it's like, oh well, then yeah, let Eriksen go. Doesn't matter. If there's a drop off, and there's every chance that there could be a drop, because as you say, Eriksen is a phenomenal creator from set pieces, but Lo Celso takes set pieces, he dribbles the ball.
Lo Celso's chances created last season, he played in a Real Betis side that had Sergio Canales.
Yeah.
Lo Celso's chance created was 27.
Yeah.
He was their top goal scorer.
Yeah,
I think they're markedly. The shift, if you lose Eriksen and then put the put those. If you put your Eriksen things from the bar, I can't formulate the idea I'm trying to say. If you move from Eriksen as Lo Celso as your chief midfielder or the key man in the midfield, then your style of play, to me, has to change.
Yeah, no,
it's a tricky one to where he's going to use Lo Celso, really, because he's played in quite a few different roles. Sometimes he can play behind a striker in a 3-5-2, sometimes a bit deeper as well. So ball progression and carrying the ball is definitely his key strength. So if you look at Wanyama, Dyer further back, they'd definitely miss that. So there'd be an argument for maybe using him further back.
Well, but that's where Ndombele comes in.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. So now they've sort of solved that problem. So if you think they're going to have Ndombele and Lo Celso, then suddenly they've got ball carriers.
I think it's Ndombele plus Winks. So you've got the stable sideways pass merchant that is the staple of modern football, and I say that with tongue in cheek because I like Harry Winks.
We love him.
So you play that, and you get your dynamism there on Ndombele. And even if you want it, you can play Sissoko. I think they need to play Lo Celso in that three behind Kane.
Yes. So I think it'd be 4-2-3-1 as well. But I think I would use him on the right of that three,
which,
and put Dele.
Which is where Eriksen starts out. If you actually look how Spurs lay out when Dele Alli is fit, Dele Alli plays in the middle because then he just goes anywhere he
and
wants.
They can be changeable, exactly. Yeah. And I think Lo Celso as well, cutting in onto his left from the right.
Yeah, an upgrade on Lamella.
Essentially,
fitter Lamella.
I think what we're going to see more of is more of this evolution of Harry Kane as the sort of, like, not just a goal scorer, but a playmaker as well. I think that's what they're maybe leaning towards more of, unleashing and then having themselves.
And then runners beyond him.
Yeah.
Doesn't bode well for my golden boot prediction.
He got two.
I mean, no, he'll still score loads of goals, isn't he? Harry Kane. But I think maybe that's what they're thinking of. But obviously the idea is Eriksen out, Lo Celso in. And Lo Celso with set pieces does that. That's maybe what they can talk about in terms of replacing Eriksen, because he takes set pieces. But Yeah, I think that's their ideal. I don't. I mean, that's interesting. It should be an interesting evolution because, of course, you have to keep changing. Otherwise, you just stagnate and you know.
That's one thing Pochettino has done. We talked about Walker and Rose there.
Yeah,
that they were the pinnacle of Pochettino's football. He was arguably the first one that pinned a lot of his hopes on his fullbacks.
Yeah,
because they were so good. When they lost both of them, they brought in a more solid version in Ben Davies, and he changed it and completely evolved. If you look at the first team to what they play now, I think it would be a stark difference. But they come up against Man City. And this is not the time where you want to be in transition. You want to be as settled and you want to know exactly what you're going to be doing. And we spent a lot of time on Spurs there, but interesting stuff. So it won't be as much on Man City. The main point I wanted to bring up was obviously we said that Kane had 2 goals. Sterling has 3 to start off with. Denied making a start to his playmaker award by VAR, which I predicted, so maybe I was wrong in putting him for that one. But someone that I think is really interesting to talk about Man City is that I personally believe Riyad Mahrez was the best player of the whole Premier League weekend last time out. If you look at his actual involvement in every goal, not the direct involvement, but he played a part in pretty much every single one, and I'm pretty sure he's going to be dropped.
I mean, yeah, because Bernardo Silva has to play, doesn't he? So, I mean, and this is the absurd power of Man City's squad. Like, Riyad Mahrez, excellent last week. By the way, we were saying, weren't we, in a review, what if Riyad Mahrez like Bernardo Silva, took a year to learn how to play for Man City, and now knows how to play for Man City. And now, okay, fine, Leroy Sane is out for the year, really. That's not good, but if Mahrez steps into the breach, maybe you won't miss him so much. But yeah, he will be dropped because Bernardo Silva didn't play last weekend. Bernardo will come in for this one. Sterling, obviously, keeps his place because he's Sterling. Mm. And so the rotation begins. And now you're looking at it and you're thinking, okay, this will be interesting. Let's see what happens. Sterling, I think, what was it? He scored 18 goals, 11 assists in 17-18, 17 goals, 10 assists in 18-19. I think he'll smash that goal record this year, clearly.
Made a good start,
hasn't he? I mean, he's already, you know, made a good way there. And assists-wise, I don't know. We'll see. He got a good assist. But it's going to be interesting to see how he evolves to make assists without Sane on the pitch. I think a lot of...
Their duo was...
Yeah, so I think that'll be interesting to see. Let's see how that works. But I think definitely he'll score loads of goals this season. I think City are just...
He's got a really good relationship in terms of chemistry with Sergio Aguero as well, which should come in handy as he takes his playmaker.
Aguero, Jesus is going
to
come in.
And just to clarify the point about Mahrez, he's been... The only reason Bernardo Silva comes... And I think it's because David Silva will still play. Ideally, I think Man and David Silva is so good. It's his last season. I want to see at one point Man City play Rodri, De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva, Mahrez, Aguero, Sterling.
I want to see that once.
But the reason I think this Bernardo Silva comes in right wing is because Bernardo Silva was the man against Spurs in every game they played last season. Mm. Remember after the crazy Champions League match, Bernardo Silva pretty much won that game. It was 1-0, but Bernardo Silva was heralded as the most complete player Man City had. Yeah. And that was the start of his campaign to become Man City's player of the year, because in every big game, you put him on the right, he'll make 5 tackles, create 5 chances, and make 5 defenders look silly in those
Man City Spurs games. It was basically, it came down to Bernardo Silva versus Son. Like, it was those two dueling, and Son in the Champions League got the better of the Man City defence, or Laporte, just whatever. And
Llorente's hand got the better of Man City's defence.
Well, yes, that too. And then
another joke.
Bernardo Silva had the edge in the Premier League, but Son suspended for this tie. He's serving the second game, the final game of his suspension, picked up in the last season. So he won't be playing, which I think gives City a huge edge, because he's obviously someone that has City's defence sussed. And I think he would have caused them a lot of trouble without him. I mean, Spurs can still cause them problems, especially if they set up very cleverly. I wonder if they'll set up with 3 across the back or 5 across the back, because that's often the best way to deal with Guardiola's side, because you can have man for man against their forwards and then also still have men available to mark the overlapping players, so the wing backs or De Bruyne.
Because, I mean, three across the back would be interesting, because obviously he didn't play Vertonghen last week. Some reports that he came back with some fitness problems, or maybe hasn't been working as hard in pre-season.
I mean, and you know, that would, to me, it's like he's so, obviously I get Pochettino, he's very much into discipline and fitness and everything.
Maybe you get Sessegnon at debut left wing back.
I mean,
that's the other signing. I keep forgetting they actually did get him in the end.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I want to see him play it as a forward, but I think he will be used as a left back for minutes first.
Wing.
And then the final point of this section, and indeed the first BetBall-sponsored Squawker Talker football podcast, is will Oleksandr Zinchenko finally end his streak? Because the Man City left back slash number 11 slash number 10 has won 22 games in a row as a Premier League player. And he's on the verge of history. But this is a huge game, obviously, to decide that. And there was a moment last season in which Laporte was on a really similar run. In fact, he was unbeaten to his start and was like trying to chase Lehmann and all of those. And then Chelsea, and then I think Chelsea beat them and ended that. And I remember that specifically because Laporte begins with L, and there were loads of puns to use. But this time I want it to be a W because Zinchenko is my content strategy for the whole weekend.
It's a really good joke.
It is. I know it is. And to follow the really good joke, I'd like to hear some really good predictions on whether it will continue to wrap up the podcast. As I said, we discussed loads there with Man City Spurs, and there's even more angles that have appeared that I'd forgotten about. But Mo, we'll start with you. Man City Spurs, what do you think is going to happen?
City are going to win. Spurs got lucky-ish against Villa, and that Villa are completely inexperienced at this level. And you get the way they just keep giving the ball away and letting Spurs come back at them. Before then, Villa, when Villa were actually in the game, it was interesting. I think City are going to win this. They've got too much head, too much quality.
Bernardo Silva.
Oh, let's say 3-1. Bernardo Silva's the man.
3-1.
3-2.
Ooh.
Entertaining game. These tend to be entertaining meetings between these two teams at the Etihad, as we saw with the VAR thing. Mm. Over the last 10 games, it's averaged 4 goals. But, and this is something I didn't realise, and there is an explanation. Spurs are on a 6-game losing streak away from home in the Premier League at the moment. Their last win was like, I think, against Fulham. And the last time they kept a clean sheet on the road while in the top flight was against Cardiff in January. So you'll imagine they will concede. As I said, the explanation probably is they're prioritising the Champions League run towards the end of the season there. Mm. But yeah, I think City...
It was the one of the clean sheets that broke up the streak was in Dortmund, wasn't it? When they were incredible defensively.
I think.
I remember the stat of being like, they've kept nine.
Not necessarily a clean sheet, but a losing streak. And one of the results that broke that up as well would have been the Ajax. Mm. The famous Ajax win.
So not another comeback. Not a famous night.
No.
Man City win. What did you think? 3-2. Sam? Final call?
I think 2-1 City with big VAR
controversy. I told you it was 2-1. Mr. 2-1.
I like the VAR shout. VAR. I like
Pep that. Guardiola again. Just going to his knee. Oh no, because it'll be in favour this time. So revenge.
VAR revenge. Finally for revenge.
And that means it's a clean sweep for Oleksandr Zinchenko this weekend. But I also think Man City will win. I don't think, for some reason, I think it's going to be like 2-0. Don't think Spurs.
You just
score.
Think, yeah, quite straightforward.
I just Man City.
I mean, Sun isn't playing.
I fall in love with Edison more each week as well. That double save he made against West Ham. I just can't see him being beaten.
Man City is increasingly getting good at everything. Like defending was like maybe the one weakness in that.
And they're getting away with all those pesky fouls.
And Rodri hasn't even adapted yet, guys. Exactly. They're going to get even better.
They're going to get better. But that, as I said, that is all we have time for this week on the Squawker Talker Football podcast. Sponsored by BetBall. Again, just to mention that. Make sure you download the app in the link below. You can follow some of those predictions, as I said. If you want 2-1s all day, then Sam will hook you up with those, but we'll mix them up a bit, maybe get some Bernardo Silva love in there as well. But thank you to all my guests for joining me, and we'll speak to you again next Thursday.
Yes, indeedy.